I know we say we had twins. She had twins. I have very little to do with this.
Your work was done in the first 30 seconds of that situation.
Yeah. Well played. Yes. Freely Filtered, the irregularly irregular podcast that summarizes and discusses recent NephJC journal clubs. NephJC is the Twitter Nephrology Journal Club where nephrologists meet in social space to discuss the research and developments that are driving nephrology forward. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and is not intended to give medical advice. If you have questions about your health, we suggest that you talk with your doctor rather than take the advice for some self-appointed randoms on a podcast. This podcast will discuss off-label and unapproved medications, but not tonight. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the PRASIS trial. This is a study that validated S-FLT to PIGF ratio to predict severe preeclampsia. This is a test that is now FDA approved and should be available to women in the United States. Tonight, we have SWAP.
Hey, I'm Swapnil Hiramad. I'm a nephrologist and epidemiologist in Ottawa, Canada. My social media handles are all HSwapnil. I don't have any conflicts today except for being scared when I get paged to the labor and delivery unit.
Excellent. Excellent. AC.
Hey, everyone. I'm AC Gomez. I'm a MedPeds nephrology fellow, and I have no conflicts of interest tonight.
Hey, AC, do you have any experience with preeclampsia?
I do not have any personal experience with preeclampsia, although I am a recently pregnant person who was terrified and may have dipped my own urine on a regular basis. It never be too sure.
I get it. Nyan.
My name's Nayan Arora. I'm a nephrologist at the University of Washington in Seattle. Like SWAP, not only do I get anxious, I have nightmares about pages from the OB floor. And my only disclosure, I guess, is that my wife actually had preeclampsia postpartum with our first child.
I thought that you cured preeclampsia by delivering the child. How do you get it postpartum?
That's my question for Anuja. I have no idea.
Excellent. I also had the same conflict of interest. My wife also had preeclampsia. We had twins. And we have a special guest tonight. We've got Anuja. Anuja Java, tell us about yourself.
Hi, everyone. I'm Anuja Java. I'm a transplant nephrologist at Washington University in St. Louis. Clinically, that's my focus, but my research interest is complement. And more recently, the last couple of years, it's actually been looking at complement in preeclampsia. So preeclampsia has been an area of recent research interest, and I'm super excited to be here.
Outstanding. Outstanding. So the field of preeclampsia, you know, again, I am not an expert in this field. I get consulted pretty rarely for these patients, thank God. And when we do, the consult's always the same. It's a patient with chronic kidney disease. The patient has accelerated blood pressure. And the question is this preeclampsia or is this their pre-existing disease? And I feel that I have very few tools to answer this. And it's a high pressure situation because if you call it preeclampsia, they're going to go and deliver this baby as soon as they can, as soon as it's safe. And that could have pretty profound implications for that child's health. On the other hand, as kind of an observer from a distance, it's been interesting to watch that we first had the CHAP study. And the CHAP study showed that treating blood pressure was safe to do. This was kind of crossing the line. We had been very nervous about treating anything but the most severe blood pressure because worried about adverse fetal and maternal outcomes. CHAP showed that that was safe. Then a few years later, we had the CHIP study that said actually pretty aggressive blood pressure control, really targeted blood pressure control less than 140s, not only was safe, but also reduced the incidence of severe preeclampsia. And it was about a 24% reduction, pretty significant reduction in these patients that are pretty high risk. And now something that we've been studying for a long time, the soluble tyrosine-like, oh my God, what is this drug? What does S-FLT stand for?
FMS-like.
Soluble FMS-like
tyrosine kinase one. Now the thing is PIGF. Is it PI because it has placental? I don't see an I there. Is it PI or PL?
And I call PL.
It's PL.
Yeah.
We wrote PIG, yeah. Didn't we? No, as you can see, we're experts on this topic.
It is the L.
Placental growth factor. It must be PL. It must be PL.
Yeah. And we have, for placental.
Yeah.
For PL.
And we have, okay. So we have type PI in all the NFJC summaries.
We've screwed this up in the first 30 seconds of this podcast, guys.
Well, this is the kind of high quality recording that our audience comes to expect. Today, we're looking at a blood test that can reliably predict this severe preeclampsia. And so it's kind of, this is kind of the piece that is missing in people that look at tests that predict AKI. They're like, so what? I know that the patient's going to get AKI. How is this going to change my management? But here's a situation where, like, it's obvious how we're going to change management because they've done the work showing that aggressive treatment of blood pressure can reduce these outcomes. And now we've got a way to predict whether you need to bring that patient in and keep them in the hospital for that aggressive blood pressure control versus sending them out. And it seems like that's the way to do it, is kind of establish the therapy at first. And they did it beautifully. First show that it's safe, then show that aggressive use improves outcomes. And now we have a blood test that allows us to predict it. It's pretty cool seeing this unfold. And I'm curious, as kind of as a spectator that looks at this as a distance, is my kind of perception of how this field is moving forward, actually how it's moving forward. And so I wish we had a maternal fetal medicine doctor or an OBGYN on this podcast to help us with that. But despite our best efforts, we were stymied with that from that.
So while, I mean, this study is more about validation of this number, right? But I think there was this research didn't come about because they looked at 100 different molecules and this seemed to be the best. I think this was the other way around, is that there was a lot of basic science saying that, hey, it looks like these things, maybe PLGF is good and maybe SFLT is bad or vice versa. No, I think I got it right. And that's why they're
both good, right? They're necessary things for placental development. It's just that there's an imbalance between them that causes, that at least predicts problems.
Yeah.
So, is that right?
One of you can educate me about this.
Yeah, so I actually, when the study came about, and this has been going on for almost 10 years, I was interested in looking at how they actually came up with this SFLT1 swap. So they actually had several candidates that they were looking at, and this paper was, I think, from Karumanchi, Dr. Mm-hmm. Anand Karumanchi, and they were thinking homocysteine and antiphospholipid antibodies, all kinds of things. I think what they did was they actually did some gene expression profiling of placental tissue. And that's when this SFLT1 was identified, because it was upregulated in preeclamptic placentas. So they had gone through multiple other candidates before they did the study. So that's, I think, how they came about this. And then they found that this is actually it's a soluble form, right? So it was a splice variant of the VEGF receptor and it lacks the transmembrane domains. So, but it was through, I think looking at multiple other candidates before they kind of tailored down on this one.
So do we know more about the function of these two things and what do they actually do?
So as far as I know, SFLT1, what they call it, is anti-angiogenic. Like, so it's anti-VEGF. So VEGF mm-hmm. is supposed to promote angiogenesis. Mm-hmm. It induces vasodilatory prostacyclins and kind of is more helps to decrease the vascular tone. Everything that's supposed to be good and glomerular healing and all of that mm-hmm. during pregnancy. And so FLT1 or soluble FLT1 antagonizes that effect. And so what we do know is that antagonizes that, and that's how it leads to all this vasoconstriction and preeclampsia. But what is not known is what is the primary trigger, what initially triggers, because we see that this is an imbalance in preeclampsia, but what we don't know is what triggered the placental problems and what triggered the SFLT1 production to begin with. So I think that piece is still missing from what I understand in preeclampsia and what's triggering it. And then there is preeclampsia and then these things are going into imbalance.
We do have good evidence that the SFLT is pathogenic, that it is not just a epiphenomena of the condition that is a good marker for it. Because early data showed they would infuse SFLT into pregnant, pick your rodent of choice, and it would induce the symptoms of preeclampsia.
So it's like a natural Avastin, what you're telling me. It's like a VEGF inhibitor. But I thought SFLT1, at least I'm reading the Nef Madness summary, plays a role in maintaining.
Or the 2024 version. This is SFLT's second dance in the big dance.
It is. This is the 2024 version, and it's telling me that it maintains the appropriate depth of the placenta into the uterine wall.
Cool.
So, meaning it's not just pathologic, right?
Right. Again, if there is an appropriate amount of estlet, and when you give when you have too much, when it's out of balance, is when you get these symptoms of.
Yeah, the excess amount is supposed to cause endothelial dysfunction and has the clinical phenotype of preeclampsia. But that's why when the ratio is high, which means the estlet is high, is causing trouble.
Okay. So there is a baseline level that is needed, but when it goes up, it's causing badness. And the PLGF is a good thing?
Yeah, so
it helps the placenta.
Placental growth factor and VEGF are good, and the estlet one is bad. So that's kind of how.
And how did you get interested in this?
Right. So my story really came from a clinical background, Joel. I think I mentioned this during our last TMA podcast as well, that as I mentioned, I'm a transplant nephrologist. So I had been seeing these patients who came to us for a pre-transplant evaluation. These were women who had developed end-stage kidney disease as a result of preeclampsia. And then they were on dialysis and they came to us for a kidney transplant evaluation. And that is really when I got interested. And this was 3-4 years ago. And, you know, kind of wondering about why would they lose their kidney during preeclampsia? Typically, it's supposed to get better postpartum, like, you know, Nan and you guys were mentioning earlier. And so what is different about these patients? So as I was already doing research in complement, that's kind of where my mind went, because, you know, it's an immune system dysfunction. I think of preeclampsia, pregnancy, from a transplant physician standpoint, as an allogenic mismatch. We've always questioned it. Why does mother not reject the baby? So from that standpoint, I always thought that there is some kind of immune dysfunction that is happening. I went ahead and did genetic sequencing on these very few, like 4 or 5 patients who I saw clinically, and we found genetic mutations in complement proteins. And so then that kind of brought to mind were these patients, did they actually have TMAs and AHAs, or was this preeclampsia and is complement involved? So that then led to my project, which is I collaborated with our OBGYN group here at WashU. We went back and looked at a cohort of high-risk preeclampsia, as I call them. These were preterm preeclampsia, less than 34 weeks, recurrent preeclampsia. And we did a whole exome sequencing, looking then specifically at complement proteins to see whether, you know, is there complement association. So that's kind of where it started, and it's ongoing, and I'm still looking at it from a complement perspective or immune-mediated perspective.
Excellent. Excellent. Nan, tell us about the study that we're talking about tonight.
Okay, so this is a multicenter blinded prospective study across 18 U.S. hospitals. There were 2 cohorts. The first was a derivation cohort where they were trying to identify a SFLT1 to PLGF ratio in pregnant women who are hospitalized with hypertensive disorders of pregnancy to try to discriminate between those who would and would not progress to severe preeclampsia. And then they tested that cutoff in the validation cohort. So like I said, women were recruited from 18 U.S. tertiary care centers and community hospitals. All the patients had to be hospitalized. They had to be adults greater than 18 years of age with a singleton pregnancy. I don't know why they specified it had to be a singleton pregnancy.
Because I think all these levels are going to be different in multiparse. Right. Is multiparse the right term?
And plus, I think there isn't multiple gestation.
Doesn't sound right.
Oh my God.
Not multiparous.
We should stop talking about this.
No, multiparous means.
How about ATN, guys?
Second or third
pregnancy.
So multiparous is wrong. Multiparous means your second or third pregnancy.
Second, third pregnancy.
So this is
once.
Twin pregnancy.
Twin pregnancy. We're talking about twins.
We don't want twins.
Twins
here,
or triplets or whatever. Yeah,
because you're gonna have a larger placenta. It's gonna throw this ratio all off.
Probably.
Or not? We don't know. It wasn't included.
But
in the
study. It's a number, right? Maybe the ratio will be also high, but it may be high at a different level. So you can't extrapolate to singleton pregnancies. Well,
and I think they have a much higher risk of preeclampsia
in the first place.
So in the first place, yeah.
Exactly. That's why I think it is an independent risk factor. So maybe they were trying to exclude those that would separately be associated with it. That's kind of. Did they exclude diabetics as well or no? Diabetes was not excluded, right?
They did not.
Yeah.
The other inclusion criteria was women had to be between 23 weeks and 34 weeks of gestation. And like I said, with a diagnosis of a hypertensive disorder of pregnancy defined by ACOG, the exclusion criteria was severe preeclampsia on admission, which makes sense, multiple gestations, or if IV heparin was used because that can alter SFLT1 levels. So for what it's worth, to be an eligible center, they had to have at least over 2,000 deliveries per year and be a level 3 neonatal intensive care unit. So after informed consent, women then provided a blood sample and they were followed for up to 2 weeks or until delivery, whichever came first. If the woman did not deliver within that 2-week period, they could re-enroll with a new blood sample that would restart that 2-week clock. Everybody was blinded to the results and all the levels were done. They were batched and didn't actually impact any of the clinical care. The primary endpoint was development of severe preeclampsia within 2 weeks of that enrollment to the study, providing that blood sample. That is defined as a blood pressure greater than or equal to 160 millimeters mercury systolic or 110 millimeters mercury diastolic on 2 occasions, at least 4 hours apart while the woman was on bed rest, thrombocytopenia to less than 100,000, impaired liver function, which was defined as at least a doubling in AST or ALT, severe persistent right upper quadrant or epigastric pain that was unresponsive to medications or could not be accounted for by an alternative diagnosis. Progressive renal insufficiency. They further defined that as a serum creatinine greater than 1.1 milligrams per deciliter or doubling of the serum creatinine concentration in the absence of other known kidney disease. Pulmonary edema, new onset cerebral or visual disturbances, and headache unresponsive to medications, and again, without an alternative diagnosis. So that's the definition of severe preeclampsia.
Right. So, and they did not create this definition of severe preeclampsia. They were just using ACOG definitions, and they were just walking us through them. These are just standard definitions. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So proteinuria is not there. I guess proteinuria is so common that it doesn't constitute being severe. Is that how I should think about it?
My understanding is that was removed in 2013 or something like that as one of the criteria.
As one of the defining criteria of preeclampsia.
Yep.
Okay. But I guess, you know, it's not, presence of proteinuria doesn't make it severe preeclampsia. It just makes it preeclampsia.
Looking for renal insufficiency. Yeah.
And for preeclampsia, if you don't have proteinuria, then they had all these additionally, now have all these additional features that would still qualify.
They're just looking for end organ damage, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
I don't know.
Proteinuria is just one of the end organ damage that can happen. Do we know why this epigastric pain, what's that got to do? Is it just one of those things that has been observed, or do we know why people get epigastric pain?
I used to think that's very classic for, you know, the...
Yeah.
It's one of the classic review systems questions that I asked, but I don't know much about it.
I remember.
Interesting, yeah. And they probably don't because, you know, it's there without any explanation of why. If we knew, oh, it is because of this reason, then we would have had that reason instead, right?
It's cool.
Yeah. There's so much about pregnancy we don't know.
Same with headache. I didn't know why that alone, but apparently that was the very first association of preeclampsia by Hippocrates in 400 BC. That was the initial description was headache.
And convulsions. They're big on convulsions too.
With preeclampsia. That's true.
And so there was an adjudication committee that consisted of maternal fetal medicine experts that were blinded to the local diagnosis as well as the SFLT1 and PLGF levels that independently reviewed all the clinical and laboratory data to assess whether they met that criteria for a severe preeclampsia at enrollment or within that 2-week period. And then 2 committee members reviewed records independently. The outcome was confirmed. If they agreed, if there was disagreement, they would brought in a third person as a tiebreaker, essentially.
So they could 2-1 the guy.
They can 2-1 the guy. There was a number of secondary endpoints, and these are essentially split into maternal, fetal, neonatal outcomes and then levels. And so that included a composite of adverse maternal outcomes, which was severe hypertension with the same definition that was included in the severe preeclampsia definition, and one or more of the following things, and that included placental abruption, cerebral hemorrhage, seizure in the absence of an underlying seizure disorder, pulmonary edema, DIC, elevated LFTs, again, thrombocytopenia within 2 weeks of enrollment, or serum creatinine greater than 1.4. there was a composite of adverse fetal and neonatal outcomes, which included delivery, which was indicated for hypertensive or placental complications of pregnancy within that 2-week period, birth weight below the 10th percentile, or fetal neonatal death. And these were basically considered, I guess, standard for other clinical trials that have been done in preeclampsia.
I don't want to get to the results, but wouldn't you expect 10% of the kids to have a percent growth size less than the 10th percentile?
So I was actually going to comment on that. This also changed from what I recollect. Their as small for gestational age cutoff, I think, used to be 25, and they've dropped it to 10th percentile. I don't know when this happened, but this is also a new addition or change in their criteria.
You mean in general, not just for the study, the definition of small for gestational age?
No, in general, the definition for SGA has changed, I think.
Well, I think, can we talk a little bit about the derivation and the validation?
Yes, I was going to talk about the statistical analysis here. I know that SWAP's been waiting for this. So the power consideration that they had, so they estimated a prevalence of severe preeclampsia in this population. So remember, it's hospitalized patients with hypertension disorders of pregnancy at 33.5%. And based on that, they calculated a sample size of 215 participants in the derivation cohort. And taking into account missing data exclusions for those patients that have severe preeclampsia on admission, they inflated that to 250 participants. For the validation cohort, they had a sample size calculation of 477 unique participants. And what they were doing in the derivation was they were looking at an SFLT1 to PLGF ratio that gave them the highest sensitivity while maintaining a specificity of at least 70%.
Right. And so I think the thought there is you want to be able to use this to have a patient who comes in with hypertension and either admit them because they're going to at high risk of getting a severe preeclampsia or send them home because there is no risk. And so a very high sensitivity, it's essentially a screening test. And if it's a negative ratio, you can be pretty assured that you're not going to miss them and they're going to be safe to go home.
Yeah, it's a rule out test.
It's a rule out test. And you'll accept that not everybody's going to get it. Your specificity is not your be all end all, but you don't want to send anybody home who has a reasonable chance of developing this going forward.
That's right.
But they're still looking for a reasonably respectable specificity, right? Like 70%.
You don't want to admit everybody because then you don't. Exactly. This is not helpful, right?
Exactly.
You do want to be able to sift some sand here.
Yeah.
They're like the Bene Gesserit, really. I'm way into Dune now. I'm sorry, guys. Okay, that's the statistical analysis. Anything else about methods that you were worried about, Nyan?
No, I think the only other thing to mention before SWAP takes his 20 minutes is that then they looked at the discriminatory ability of all these biomarkers with an area under a curve comparing the ratio to kind of standard biomarkers that were used.
Yeah, and I think that'll be easier to talk about when we get to the results because it's a really cool figure. It's one of my favorite figures in the whole article. Swap, you didn't even read the article. Do you have any comments on the method? Come on.
No, this is pretty decent, right? What they've done with the idea of derivation and validation.
You know, for an article I haven't read, it's one of the best methods I've ever seen.
I read it like 5 minutes before, but they followed all the right rules. They have done all the right things. You can't fault them for any of these things.
I think they had a lot of prior art. That this study has essentially been done a few times in Europe before, slightly different. They were looking at 4 weeks rather than 2 weeks. Like there's some kind of modifications, but this is a well-worn path that they were going down, which I think really helps when designing the studies. If you're doing the third study, you can kind of see all the mistakes that were made before, and that helps. And a lot of this was like trying to get this tucked away for an FDA approval. And the FDA, I believe, was a little bit suspicious of the European because it was a much more homogenous population. And we have, you know, there are not a lot of Hispanics and African-Americans in Europe, kind of by definition.
And the risk factors there were less too. And I think that's why they looked at 4 weeks versus 2 weeks or something.
Tell me, I don't understand that. Walk me through that.
When I was reading through this, I think they talked about the risk factors that we have in the U.S. compared to the European risk factors were much different. You know, the obesity rates and the diabetes and all that that comes here. I think it's a much healthier population, more homogenous, as you said.
In Europe, and we have a higher risk. And we're seeing that. We're seeing much greater risk of preeclampsia. One of the things that I think I will get into the results, so I won't spoil that, but there's some interesting... Actually, the thing that was part of the methods is they said that there's regional differences in the rate of preeclampsia, and the South has the highest. It was like 35%, I thought, is what I read. So it's pretty wild how much difference you can see there.
This is going to be one of my many dumb questions about preeclampsia. Does anybody know why 20 weeks is the cutoff? Is that where these factors are more active? Something's going on with the placenta. Why do we use 20 weeks as the cutoff for preeclampsia?
Probably something to do with the placenta implantation or whatever.
And that's the kind of answers you get when you listen to a podcast of scientists here. It's probably something to do with placenta. Swap, I think you're right. I think it does have something to do with placenta. I think you're onto something there.
Yeah, like if it happens before 20 weeks, it's something else, right? That's not preeclampsia.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, probably the trophoblast invasion, whatever that is. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, it's probably the trophoblast. I agree.
Oh, man.
I just got to say, we tried, right? We really tried to bring someone in here, okay? AC, tell us about the results. What do we have to look forward to here?
Okay, so from 2019 to 2021, they enrolled 1,014 pregnant women across the 18 U.S. hospitals that we talked about, again, with singles and pregnancy, and then a hypertensive disorder of pregnancy. So for the overall cohort, the mean gestational age in enrollment was 30 weeks. The range went from 23 to 35, and then the mean age of the women was 31, with a range of 18 to 50. And then in terms of the breakdown for race, 31% reported Black race, and then 47% of this cohort had pre-existing chronic hypertension. And so the reason that the authors just wanted to highlight this...
Rewind it. 40 what percent?
Seven.
Nearly half these women... They were only 31 years old, reported pre-existing hypertension.
Yes, I believe so.
And I guess that's because that's an enrollment criteria that we see such a high rate, right? Because we're looking for high-risk patients. Yeah. But that is
47%.
That's just remarkable.
Yeah. And so one of the things that they, you know, just wanted to note was that this overall was a fairly representative population in terms of women with hypertension or pregnant women with hypertension in the United States, which is not something that we always see in these clinical trials, that our trial population is representative of the U.S. population or the population that we're studying, right? So other things, so the average highest systolic blood pressure at enrollment was 162 millimeters of mercury and then 96 for the diastolic. And the median urine protein to creatinine ratio at enrollment was 0.31 with an interquartile range of 0.16 to 1.04. And so the first thing that we have is the derivation cohort. The mean age was almost 32 years. In terms of the breakdown for race, 7.3% of the cohort was Asian, 34.1% was Black, and 47.7% was white, and then 22% were Hispanic. Just some other things that I thought were interesting was that the mean first trimester BMI was 33.8, and then almost 10% of this derivation cohort were smokers. The mean gestational age in enrollment was similar to the overall cohort at 30 weeks, and the average highest systolic and diastolic blood pressures were 155 and 92, respectively. Just looking at the derivation cohort first, the incidence of preeclampsia with severe features that developed within those 2 weeks was 31.3%, so almost a third of these patients.
Which is what they predicted. They hit their analysis. Yeah.
Yeah, that was perfect. Yeah. They hit it right on.
And the median S-split to PLGF ratio difference between the two groups. So between the groups who developed this within the first 2 weeks, it was 200 with an interquartile range of 53 to 458. And for those who didn't, the median ratio was 6. And the p-value is less than 0.001. And then because you could re-enroll, so like we talked about in the method, so if you didn't hit any of the endpoints in the first 2 weeks, you could re-enroll after that and get a new blood draw and enroll for the next 2 weeks. They also looked at this restricting to either the first or the last enrollment, and they found that the findings were similar. That really didn't change anything.
Yeah, it didn't make a difference. That's a cool figure one.
Yeah,
where you can see that is a cool way to do that. Anytime they talk about the ratio, they do it on this logarithmic scale, which just kind of compresses the difference between these. Like, you know, I'm just looking at that figure one.
And yeah, like, I mean, if you look at the scale, right, it goes from 1, 10, 40, yeah. 100, 1,000, 10,000.
Yeah.
So if you didn't have a logarithmic, it would be all
scattered. It'd be a mile apart.
It'd be huge.
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite skewed. So either geometric or logarithmic makes a lot of sense to show it in a sensible way that our human minds can understand it.
The human minds can never understand logarithmic analysis. It's always the worst way to present data. I never get it.
So what they found with this derivation cohort was that an SLIT 1 to PLGF ratio of greater than or equal to 40 had an 81% sensitivity and an 81% specificity. And the positive predictive value was 66% and the negative predictive value was 90% for the primary outcome. So like we talked about, what they're really looking at, perhaps most importantly, is as a rule out. So then they went on to test the performance of this. So they just kind of decided this was the discriminatory ratio. So then they went on to test it in a validation cohort. So here they enrolled women across all of the 18 hospitals, and there were 556 women after the exclusion criteria. And again, relatively similar characteristics. So mean age of 32 years. 6% of them were Asian, 30% Black, 53.2% white, and 16% Hispanic. Average first trimester BMI, again, was high, 35.2, and then 8.5% current smokers. Average gestational age at enrollment was similar at 30.4 weeks, and the highest systolic and diastolic were 158.5 and 94.8, respectively. So in this group, again, the incidence of severe preeclampsia or preeclampsia with severe features within those 2 weeks was 33.5%. So again, relatively similar. The median ratio was consistently elevated in the women who developed preeclampsia with severe features, and that was true across clinical sites. So among those developing preeclampsia with severe features, the median was 291 versus 7 in those who didn't. So the ratio was roughly 40 times higher. And then, so what they concluded based on these data was that the ratio of greater than 40 had a 94% sensitivity and a 75% specificity, and a positive predictive value in this group at least of 65% and negative predictive value of 96%. And then if they restricted the analysis to women with a history of chronic hypertension, which again is just a different group, then the positive predictive value was 59% and the negative predictive value is 94%. And then they again looked at that among people with Black race and found a positive predictive value of 66% and a negative predictive value of 99%. So
really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So then what they looked at, which we kind of alluded to before, was the receiver operating characteristic curves for this SLIT 1 to PLGF ratio versus any of the kind of standard of care assessments that we have right now. Blood pressure, LFTs, platelet count, creatinine, and the area under the curve for the ratio was 0.92 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.89 to 0.94, whereas for all of the other ones, it was less than 0.75. So if you look
at this, this is figure two of the document, and it is just like everything that we use, everything that when we go about it, sucks.
Right?
Yeah. It's just a coin toss. Yeah. And then you've got this thing, this SFLT to PLGF, and it's really pretty impressive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like not even close. Everything else pretty much equally sucks. And then this is much, much better.
And then did they ever do just the, ask the doctor, what do you think? You think this patient's going to get, did they just get like clinical acumen? Just like, I think this one feels bad. You know, the doctor's left toe hurts a little bit when the patient comes in, they have preeclampsia. They do like, you know, best clinical guess. Yeah. Okay. I would have liked it.
But I think the way the cohort is built is sort of those kind of patients, right? That's why they had 30% preeclampsia. It's like, would I be surprised if any of these patients develop preeclampsia? No, but you know, that's
the surprise test used here.
Yeah.
Fair.
So you need something that this improved upon, you know, the fact that they are choosing these kind of patients is pretty impressive.
You know, funny, we didn't talk about the derivation cohort. There's this interesting figure, S3, in the supplement. Did you guys take a look at this one? This is showing they have the sensitivity rates with the different cutoffs and the specificity rates with the different cutoffs, and they superimposed them, and you can see why they pick 40, because it's the point that kind of maximizes both of these.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's actually pretty cool. as your ratio cutoff goes up, your specificity goes up higher and higher.
Right.
Like you start to really, you drop off in sensitivity, but you're you're much more likely to actually develop the disease. You'll miss some people that don't have that high ratio. So yes. And the other thing was as the ratios went up, and I know AC is about to get this. I don't want to, you know, spoil it, but they had more adverse events.
Yeah.
Right.
The secondary outcomes really started to.
So it's like a more severe phenotype that you get or something? Or,
yeah,
or
for sure.
Or the worst kind of preeclampsia?
But these levels can differ based on the where you run them, right? Different labs produce different values.
But
is that why there's been different ratios between papers?
Well, remember, that different papers had different outcomes. So that might be also part of that.
Too. No, but I think their assays are different and their ranges may be different. But then you would probably go by the range of the lab that you're doing. I don't know how much it varies, but I think we discussed that during our NEFJC, right? That there are differences in.
Well, and this is why they had to do the derivation study. Using this assay, what was the number that was best predicted? They didn't know that going in.
Just another thing to note was that they kind of they added in the systolic pressure and the biochemical test to see if adding in any of those improved the accuracy or the area under the curve compared to just the ratio. And it doesn't improve it at all to the PLGF ratio. So just it on its own is kind of the optimal thing that they found. And then in the validation cohort, there were 51 adverse maternal outcomes. And the ratio was roughly 10 times higher for those who developed adverse maternal outcomes compared to those who didn't. So 279 versus 22. And then two women went on to develop eclampsia, and they had really markedly elevated ratios. So they were 4,975 and 4,698, respectively, at enrollment. Significantly elevated even compared to a lot of the other women that we're talking about. And then in terms of composite adverse maternal outcomes, they were more common in the group with a ratio of greater than or equal to 40 compared to those with less than 40. So 16.1% versus 2.8%. So the risk ratio was 5.8. And then the relative risks were especially high for severe thrombocytopenia, which was 3.4% versus 0.4%, a risk ratio of 9.7, or elevated liver enzymes, which was 9.7% versus 0.7%. With a risk ratio of 14.1, although the confidence intervals on those are both relatively large, but still quite elevated risk ratios.
I guess the only thing about the confidence intervals is when you're talking about secondary outcomes, the study's not powered.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it's not surprising.
And you've got smaller n, so that's expected.
Yeah, and they had fewer patients. That's right. Thank God.
Yeah. There were 288 adverse fetal and neonatal outcomes. And for those, the SFLT to PLGF ratio was 30 times higher in women with adverse fetal and neonatal outcomes compared to those without. So 182 versus 6. And then the composite adverse fetal and neonatal outcomes were more prevalent in the group with the ratio greater than or equal to 40 compared to those with less than 40. So 79.8% versus 26%. And a risk ratio of 3.1.
I mean, they stacked the deck a little bit. If indicated delivery is one of the adverse outcomes. If you have preeclampsia, you're going to deliver. So they really stack the deck in the fetal adverse outcomes category.
Yeah, but look at like fetal and neonatal death.
Yeah, so
eight of them.
Yeah, so
greater than 40 versus one indicated delivery less than 14 days. That's problematic because that's going to be your definitive treatment for severe preeclampsia. What about some of the other adverse fetal outcomes?
Yeah, so in terms of some of the other adverse fetal outcomes, there were 9 fetal deaths, 8 of which were in the group with the ratio of greater than or equal to 40, and so 1 in the other group. So the risk ratio for that was 8.7, and then among women with a ratio of greater than or equal to 40, the incidence of a child that was small for gestational age was 30% compared with 8% among women with a ratio of less than 40. So the risk ratio there of 3.7.
So it's interesting. So 8% is pretty close to what you'd predict for less than 10th percentile. Like it seems to be kind of just normal, right?
Yeah.
For the women that have a ratio less than 40, and it just balloons with the ratio greater than 40. Really interesting.
Women with an SFLT to PLGF ratio of greater than or equal to 40 were more likely to deliver, and that was spontaneous delivery or induced delivery within 2 weeks compared to women with a ratio of less than 40. And they adjusted that. So they looked at the hazard ratio and then adjusted it for maternal age, parity, gestational age of presentation, systolic blood pressures, lab tests, everything they could think of. And regardless, the hazard ratio remained greater than 1. So for delivery, it was 3.1. And then they looked at the relationship between the ratio at enrollment and then the delivery interval. And what they found was an inverse dose response relationship. So this kind of gets to one of the questions earlier between the ratio and the delivery interval. They looked at that in quartiles and then as a continuous variable.
This is the one I kind of had trouble really figuring out what they were showing in the figure.
So what we have here, it's a Kaplan-Meier curve looking at the probability of remaining undelivered. So everybody at the beginning of 14 weeks has a baby inside them and they are at 100% undelivered. And that as the S-flit ratio goes up, they deliver faster. So that if you look in the fourth quartile, the highest 25% of S-flit ratio, which is actually really crazy high. I think they actually defined them what that ratio is. And I remember looking at it, I was like, wow, that's a really high ratio. But only 16% of them remained undelivered at 14 days versus 50% in the third quartile, 71% in the second quartile, and 80% in the first quartile.
They had ratios up to 7,370.
Where is that number?
That's insane. It's in the annotation of figure 3.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. Okay. Quartile 4 was 221 to 7370. Okay. That makes sense.
That seems bad.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, but it's sort of like when we look at a biomarker, you want to look at many different things, right? And one of them is that there is a biological gradient. It's good to see that, you know, the higher it is, the worse it is. It's not like, you know, it's some chance number that is high. There are many different relationships and it all fits together. The story all fits.
Pans out as things get worse, right?
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, and there was prior art that they were doing apheresis, removing S-flit with different technologies, and those patients had decreased proteinuria and apparently improved.
Yeah, and you kind of wonder with those two people who had like the ratio in the thousands, you know, maybe that might be a consideration, right? It's really, really high. Bad things are going to happen. Deliver them, but if not, for whatever reason, yeah. Yeah, that would be an option, perhaps.
Yeah, and the ratios really kind of stood through. I think AC will go over the false negative, false positive findings, but I think I found that very telling of this particular test on of how it predicts outcomes, not only for preeclampsia, but for other things. And I think we'll go over that.
AC, what else you got?
So one of the other things that they looked at was who had these outcomes or didn't have these outcomes, like who basically was in the ratio of less than 40 group who ended up going on to develop severe preeclampsia. And then
the misses, the ones that you would have missed.
The misses, exactly. Yeah. So there were 12 women with a ratio of less than 40 who developed preeclampsia with severe features within those 2 weeks. And 10 of those 12 had chronic hypertension before they were enrolled. So it seems like the group that started out with chronic hypertension seems to be perhaps a little bit more at risk or could be some of the people we could miss, which to your point is kind of scary when you're thinking about getting these consults. Is it necessarily reassuring to say, well, they had hypertension before and I think this is their kind of chronic hypertension, right? It may not be. And so I think it's interesting to know that those are some of the people that were missed. And then 93 women with a ratio of greater than or equal to 40 did not develop preeclampsia with severe features, but 53 of those did still have adverse fetal or neonatal outcomes. So either growth restriction or a non-reassuring fetal status. And then 2 of them developed placental abruption, which is another really, really horrific outcome.
You're not going to feel bad about admitting them for observation if they end up getting an abruption. You'd be like, okay, I made the right call.
Yeah.
Even if they didn't develop severe preeclampsia.
Exactly. Okay. And so looking at those who didn't develop preeclampsia with severe features, those with a ratio of greater than 40, greater than or equal to 40, also delivered earlier. So even if you didn't develop the preeclampsia with severe features, you were still at risk of delivering earlier.
Okay. Anything else?
No, I think that's what I have.
Anuja, what were you talking about with sensitivity specificity? This is something that you were looking at.
No, I wasn't saying anything, Joel, about this.
She's like, now she denies
it. She was saying the false negative and false positive findings, which is what we just talked about.
That's what I was saying. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. No, I was mentioning what AC just covered, that I thought that the ratio of more than 40, kind of, even though they didn't develop severe PE, the fact that these patients still had bad outcomes in terms of fetal or neonatal outcomes was still pretty telling that this ratio is significant.
Right. Because you look at that list of defining characteristics of severe preeclampsia, and a lot of them are arbitrary calls. The SGL, the liver enzymes have to go here, and the blood pressure has to go here, and they may not cross those lines, but they're still going to be at risk. It's dichotomization unleashed.
Anuja, has this type of thing, obviously not these specific biomarkers, but this whole issue with, you know, these imbalances been looked at in other causes of TMAs or autoimmune disorders? Do you know anything, if there's anybody looking into whether this happens in other diseases other than, I'm not going to call pregnancy a disease. We're going to edit that out. Other conditions.
This particular ratio, Nayan, or other?
Other biomarkers looking at, you know, balance ratios with that happen in lupus? Happen in, you know, other complement disorders?
Right. This reminds me really, a couple things that reminded me of the study. You know, the derivation and the validation cohort is really how they came up with the plasmic score for TTP. This was very similar study that they did. That was number one. Number two, when you're talking about ratios, they have looked at biomarkers like IC3B to C3 total C3 ratio. They have tried to look at some of those for lupus, kind of been discussed a little bit with TMA, but hasn't been panned out. I think from the TMA or the complement perspective, I think there we will not, I don't think we'll be able to come up with like one ratio. We'll always be looking at a composite, like a score or a predictive value or something that has three or four different things, because you know, complement by itself, there's no one marker that can define anything. You always have to look at a few different things. But that ratio has been looked at just from a C3B perspective. But I don't think much panned out of that.
And then does anybody know the biggest thing I've dealt with in my own practice is trying to differentiate a lupus flare with preeclampsia? Yeah. Because I feel like that's the age range and that's the cohort that I see. Do we know anything about these levels in that? Because I would love to not have to biopsy people who are, you know, 25 weeks pregnant.
So I think they had a paper, not for lupus, Nan, but there was a paper just looking at this in CKD.
Right? In CKD. Right. Yeah, it wasn't actually the ratio. They were just looking at, I think it was just the placental growth factor.
Yes, this is the placental growth factor. That's right.
And it worked. They didn't lose anything with the CKD. It was actually pretty impressive.
Right. Yeah, we actually had a recent GN chat and they presented a case exactly what you're asking. Look, they had a patient who actually had a history of lupus and then presented with what you would call preeclampsia. And we didn't have a conclusion on what you would do. There was quite a bit of discussion about biopsy, non-biopsy. We were looking at complement levels. And I think you can't really... I don't think there's any one way you would be able to differentiate.
This is shaping up to be a biomarker that is going to be very useful. We already have some data showing that if you remove it with phoresis, those patients seem to do better. That's going to be an obvious drug target. It predicts whether they develop this. It predicts prognosis for both the mother and the fetus. It'd be interesting to see, you know, we know that aspirin reduces the risk of preeclampsia. Does it affect these levels, right? Is that something, when you start on aspirin, does the ratio improve?
Wouldn't all these women be on aspirin anyways? Because
they only had 40% of patients on aspirin in this study.
Yeah. So that's kind of not
a failure.
Good, right?
Yes. We screwed that up. We didn't get these patients on appropriate.
Yeah, and it's kind of a persistent theme. I think this came up when we discussed CHAP as well, right? We don't use aspirin as much.
We don't use aspirin as much as we should. Yeah.
No, but was that 40% prior to enrollment? Because 40% had chronic hypertension, right? Before. Why would they be on aspirin before that?
I mean, they're at high risk of preeclampsia, so.
45%. It was outpatient aspirin use in the validation cohort was 45%, and the derivation cohort was 45% also.
So I thought we gave people who are at high risk of preeclampsia should get aspirin. Am I wrong?
No, but that's the people that had gestational hypertension, right, going in. Which was about the same percentage.
Is it the same percentage? Is it the overlap in those patients? Is that... Or no?
We don't have...
That's what I'm assuming. We don't know that, but presumably, you know, 55% of these patients had new onset hypertension, so they didn't necessarily have an indication for aspirin before enrollment.
Okay. You're trying to be charitable.
Is an elevated BMI a risk factor for preeclampsia?
Yes.
It is.
Okay.
So that might be another indication for them to get aspirin therapy.
It'll be kind of interesting, you know, like there are some women who got preeclampsia-like features despite having a lower ratio. And you wonder if maybe they have a different disease, right?
That's exactly what I was going to say. So that's what's been running in my mind. Like, what's up with these 10 or 12 people? Like, what's their mechanism? There is something different about them. Exactly. That's I wanted to mention.
And maybe like, PLA2 and membranous, we'll find out, hey, there's something else. Some other marker
another,
is up.
There's another disease with the same phenotype. Yeah. That's super interesting.
Yeah.
Anuja, also, is this... Do we know anything about, is this like a two-hit hypothesis? Are people predisposed to preeclampsia because of inherited factors, hereditary factors? Is this like when I give people calcineurin inhibitors and they get TMA and they probably have some underlying predisposition?
Yeah, there is a genetic predisposition, and from everything that I've been learning about it the last couple of years. In fact, that's kind of why we're looking at it, because it's said that if mothers have preeclampsia, their daughters are more high risk for developing preeclampsia. There's also some data to show that.
But what about it? Never mind. That's fine. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I was going
to say, what about their sons? But their sons actually are completely resistant to preeclampsia. There's zero penetrance there.
I was coming to the paternal factors because, there is some concern about paternal genetics interfering too, because if you think about the fetus, it's maternal, paternal, both, right? So the placenta is thought to be, a lot of it is fetal, right? There is only small part the maternal part that makes it. So there is some thought that the fetal genetics predisposed to it, and fetal genetics also has paternal genetics. So there is some underlying genetic etiology to this that has been talked about. And I think that in, on top of whatever other predisposing factors there are. So I don't know if I would call it two hit as such, but I do think that there is a predisposition.
Excellent. Anuja, do you have any other final thoughts about this paper that you want to share?
Well, I mean, I guess the main thing is, I think it's a great biomarker. I think what we were talking about, the main thing is for it to be available, number one, and for it to be available in a timely manner. I think we talked about this earlier. I think it's an ELISA method, and if it's an assay that can be done quickly, but it takes 2 weeks to come back, then it's of no benefit to our patients, because there's no point. So, and the
that's
other
how thing, it is for
yeah.
us.
And the other
yeah,
thing,
it's a send-out test.
Because, and when I was looking through this, I saw that in somewhere they had mentioned that they were able to do the placental growth factor as a point of care. And so, and I haven't looked that back at that paper again, but if that's the case, then why can't they do the SFLT1 as a point of care? And if that's kind of where this should ultimately go, because not being able to make it available in a timely manner is kind of what defeats the
point. What's the point of this if it's going to be back in 2 weeks, by which time bad things have happened already?
Same thing as Adam TS13, right? I mean, I keep going back to my TMS story. But if you can get an Adam TS13 in time, then how do you rule things out? And I think that's going to be the next best thing we need to do with this, is make it available in time.
Swap, you got any thoughts?
No, this is a really well done study. Again, it comes, as we discussed earlier, it comes after, a lot of science and a lot of work. But this was the step that was needed to get the FDA approval, and now the test is available everywhere. That's how you change practice. That's how you bring research into clinical practice, is by doing these kind of studies.
Hey, see?
I agree with that. I think it'll be really interesting to see how this, especially having gone through recently, how this changes practice in the future. Although I doubt that I'll still be going through pregnancies when this one day becomes kind of more widespread use. But I think it'll be really interesting to see how this helps us to kind of prevent these things and more aggressively manage these women and predict this before things go awry.
And do you have any final thoughts?
I think it's cool that not only is this hopefully going to be more widely available for diagnosis, but this is prompting assessments of treatment for this. And there's, these things looking at interfering molecules of SFLT1 as a potential treatment. This is why this should win the Neph Madness region, because you put prevention in anything, people love it. But this is game changing, I think.
When we set up the recording, we had intended to have an additional content expert, an OBGYN in maternal fetal medicine. In the end, she got kiboshed by her work schedule, but Shannon Clark did come and talk with me a couple days later. Here is a portion of that conversation. I think it's interesting because it's quite a different perspective than we had during the meeting. Joel Toff here. We tried to get Shannon on the podcast when we were there, but medicine conspired against us and she was unable to make it. So Shannon, why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay, I'm Shannon Clark. I am a professor in maternal fetal medicine at UTMB Galveston, Texas, where I have been there since 2004, my fellowship 04 to 07, and I stayed on as faculty. So they're not going to get rid of me.
Excellent, excellent. And you said you're on the socials?
Yes.
What are your handles?
I am on social media, most active on Instagram at Babies After 35.
Babies After 35?
Is that's a whole other story.
No, that's fine. Is the 35 spelled out or is it just all one word?
35. Babies After 35.
I started the podcast kind of saying, hey, you know, I'm a bit of an outsider. Like we usually get called into these cases when it's a patient who has got chronic kidney disease and now they've got proteinuria and they're late in their pregnancy and they're like, is this their chronic kidney disease or is this preeclampsia? And I don't feel like I have a lot of tools to be able to answer that question. It's always a difficult consult for us. So I'm like, I call myself a preeclampsia spectator. I've been looking at the field.
Yeah.
And as a spectator, it looks like a field that is moving forward in an intelligent and logical motion. So I'm going to kind of walk through my data points. So one, we now have good large studies showing that we have a preventive strategy for people at high risk with aspirin.
Yes.
And then we kind of went through a series of studies looking at how to treat preeclampsia. We first had CHAP saying, hey, all of our concern about this blood pressure treatment in women and for fetuses is not as nearly as concerning that it's safe to treat blood pressure.
CHAP is not for treating preeclampsia, though. That's just for those. Right. Okay.
Fair enough. And then we had CHIP, which showed that not only is it safe, but it's actually beneficial. And now we can actually reduce severe outcomes for that. Now we have an FDA approved test, and it's actually an FDA approved test that's based on pretty solid basic science evidence moving forward in terms of the etiology behind this with this ratio of S-FLT to placental growth factor. So that's from the outside looking in. How does it feel like being on the inside of the walls?
I'll just sum it up for you. This FDA-approved test is a predictability test, plain and simple.
Uh-huh.
It is not going to change clinical outcomes. It's not there's no clinical utility, meaning, you know, in this study, you had patients that were hospitalized for hypertensive disorders of pregnancy.
Yep.
Like gestational hypertension, preeclampsia without severe features.
Right.
Now, preeclampsia, gestational hypertensives can be managed outpatient. Preeclampsia without severe features can be managed outpatient in the appropriate patient population, meaning those that have good follow-up are able to come back in for their follow-up antenatal testing, their laboratory testing, their weekly blood pressure checks, amniotic fluid indexes. So reliable transportation is key, and not everyone has that, nor do they have the resources to go back and forth to the clinic to get all these tests done or the ultrasound unit to get all these tests done. So you have to make sure the patient's a good candidate for outpatient management of preeclampsia without severe features before you send them home. There are some that are not, and we keep them in-house. If you have preeclampsia without severe features, that means we keep them in-house until 37 weeks and then deliver, okay? Or they can be managed outpatient if they're a good candidate. If in that time period, something changes in their labs, their symptoms, the surveillance on the fetus, that may require warrant earlier delivery. Then you have preeclampsia with severe features, which is managed in-house. And delivery is recommended at 34 weeks unless something occurs earlier than that. You know, changes, placental abruption, bleeding, you know, uncontrolled blood pressure, things like that. So with this test, they looked at those with gestational hypertension and those with preeclampsia without severe features to see that this ratio with S-FLT and placental growth factor changed over the course of time. And they first had the derivation cohort to find the cutoff value for the ratio. Then they had the validation cohort. And so they found that anything over 40, and there's this very specific measurement. I think it was the picograms, and you don't quote me on that, but the measurements for the, you know, they did clarify that it needs to be a specific way to measure this ratio. If it was over the greater than equal to 40, they could predict with the 96% accuracy those patients who went on to develop preeclampsia with severe features, meaning progression of the disease. Okay, so what do we do with that? It's a predictability test. So if I have a patient admitted, am I going to send her home based on that? Am I going to do less testing?
The interesting part of this test is the people that are not positive. The interesting ones are the people that are negative, right? That
yes.
It was it's a rule out test to allow the patients to be presumably discharged for the outpatient management you were describing earlier.
So I would not even use that to send patients home. Because again, there's more to it than just a test. You have to look at the overall patient, their other comorbidities, the social determinants of health, meaning do they have the resources to be managed as an outpatient? There is no way that I would send any patient based on one test home for outpatient management or preeclampsia without severe features without knowing all of that, because it requires intensive outpatient management. Plus, they're still going to need that management. I'm not going to send them home and not do the testing, not do the maternal testing, not do the antenatal fetal surveillance based on that test. So the whole point is it going to change our clinical management of the patient? So this test doesn't give us any clinical utility, meaning are we able to send them home without any test? Are we able to send them home without any fetal surveillance? And the answer is no, we can't do that based on the results of this test. You might feel more comfortable sending them home, but you have to still look at the patient, what they're able to do as a follow-up if they are at home, and do I do less testing? And the answer at this point is no. This test is not going to make me feel better about sending them home and doing less surveillance. They're still going to get all the testing. Does that make sense?
If you know with, you know, whatever, 80% certainty that this patient is going to progress to severe preeclampsia, that wouldn't change, because, you know, this was better than any other. They looked at all the other factors that you could measure at that first 2 week measure, and nothing was as close at discriminating whether these patients were going to develop that outcome or not. It seems like it would have to change at some point your decision making in terms of.
We need that testing to show what we're able to not do. Meaning that, okay, say I have a 28 weeker preeclampsia without severe features. She's able to do outpatient management.
Yep.
Am I going to not do any testing on her? The whole point of this test is to either A, manage them at home.
Yep.
If they're less than 40, decrease the maternal and fetal surveillance. Or third one is going to be, if it's greater than 40, do we just deliver them? And the answer to all those questions is no. If I have somebody that's 28 weeks with a greater than 40 cutoff, does that mean in 2 weeks I'm going to deliver them? No, that's still a 30-week fetus, right? So that's not going to change my management of them. If they are less than that, am I going to send this 28-weeker with preeclampsia without severe features home with no surveillance? The answer is no. We're still going to get.
But you could send them home with the surveillance, right?
Yes, yes, yes. So how is this test? I'll pose a question to you. How is this test going to change what we do? Is it going to change anything different?
So if you had 80% certainty that they were going to develop severe preeclampsia in the next 2 weeks, mm-hmm. you wouldn't send them home, right? You'd keep them in.
If they're candidates for outpatient management, we could potentially send them home.
This wouldn't
be different. So you could either do it inpatient or outpatient. If they're preeclampsia without severe features, that test right now doesn't tell us that we could send them home or we have to keep them in house. That is not going to tell us either way. So some people may use that test, but it's not appropriate management because we don't know. For example, placental abruption can happen in a preeclampsia without severe features at the drop of a hat. You don't know. So you have to counsel the patient before you could send them home on outpatient management with preeclampsia without severe features. They need to be close to the hospital, have reliable transportation. All of those things are ideal. And the reason why this counseling before outpatient management is so important, most of my patients live hours from my hospital. We have a very demographically diverse, and we also have patients that live far away. So I need to know that my patients with preeclampsia without severe features, before I manage them as an outpatient, could do all these clinic visits, can still have close, reliable transportation to get to the hospital in a timely fashion, and that the hospital next to them, the closest hospital next to them, which may not be mine, has the NICU capable of delivering a premature fetus. All those things have to go in play before you send someone home. And this test is not going to make me feel any more comfortable doing that. Is that making sense?
Sure, sure. How widely is this available? Is this test available at your hospital?
No.
And do you have a sense of how available it is?
I do not, and I don't know of anyone in my field that's using it as
nobody.
I don't know. I mean, okay, let's think about this other side of this. A lot of patients have preeclampsia, right?
Yeah. 5% of pregnancies, right?
Right. So in my field, we have a lot of patients that have it. I mean, I see it a lot, right?
I would imagine.
So now we have this test. What's the cost of this test? This is a predictability test. It's not going to change my management of the patient. So this company is going to, and I'm just going to play the other side of this coin. This company is going to make a lot of money. And I find this very similar to the fetal fibronectin test, which is supposed to predict preterm labor. This company made a ton of money off the fetal fibronectin test. It did not change clinical outcomes. It did not change anything. It did not change the outcomes of people with preterm birth that had a positive test or a negative test. It didn't change anything. Before we implement this test into our blood, when we do our labs, you do CBC, creatinine, blah, blah, LFTs, and this ratio. right now, there is no way to incorporate it into how we clinically manage these patients, because we're not going to feel more comfortable sending them home or keeping them in house without considering all these other factors that I just mentioned. I think it's great that we have something like this, but we have to have other studies to show.
Okay, well, let's flip it around. If you say it's great, you haven't given me any reason. You haven't given me any reason to think that you think it's great. Actually, you've given me a lot of reasons to think that you don't think it's great.
It's great that we're finding things that we could continue to build on, to do further studies on, to see if we can use these things to change the management. The hope, when I read these papers and when I read everything that was out in the media when this test came, this test predicts those who could get preeclampsia. That's not true. That's not what it does. It predicts the progression of preeclampsia. So that was kind of misleading in the media to begin with. So all these patients, and I do a lot on social media, a lot. Well, I just need to get this test to see if I'm going to get preeclampsia. That is not what this is. It's in those who already have a hypertensive disorder of pregnancy, who were hospitalized for whatever reason. And just as a side note, those with gestational hypertension are not typically kept in the hospital for prolonged periods of time. It's typically those with preeclampsia with or without severe features. So really the group that you're looking at is those without severe features, preeclampsia without severe features. Can we send them home? Do we keep them in house? Do we need to, can we stop, you know, not get as many blood draws? Can we not do as many ultrasounds for our NSTs, BPPs, the AFIs that we do on these patients? Because where I'm at, if we have a preeclamptic without severe features and they're a candidate for outpatient management, they're going to get a weekly AFI, twice weekly NSTs, or a BPP, depending on how, what gestational age they are, weekly labs. So they're making a lot of clinic visits and ultrasound visits. This test is not going to change that. And it's also not going to help me determine who can go home, because one test alone is not going to determine who is a good patient, good candidate for outpatient management. There are a lot of other factors that are figured in before making that decision. And that decision has to be made with looking at the patient in total, her social support. Again, where she lives, how close she is to a hospital, how close she is to a hospital with the appropriate level of NICU, depending on what gestational age she is. So in reality, if this test is being used clinically, it's more for patients who have the privilege of being close to the hospital and having all these things at their fingertips, and not all patients do.
Excellent. Excellent. What is the next step that we need in preeclampsia to move the ball forward?
Well, I mean, I think that in preeclampsia or with this ratio?
Preeclampsia. Or the ratio. Let's flip this around. Is there a study that you're like, boy, I really wish they had run the study this way? Because that would really have helped me make a difference.
Let's go back to the manuscript that was used for the company to make this study that was FDA approved, by the way. There was one line in the study that kind of irked me a little bit, if you will. They said, prior studies suggest that preeclampsia is characterized by angiogenic factor imbalance. I mean, I think with SFLT1 or SFLT or however you want to say it, and the placental growth like factor ratio, I think we can safely say that it is, right? And then they go on to say levels of SFLT1 and or placental growth factor, both angiogenic placental proteins, may be used to predict, diagnose, and prognosticate women with a suspicion of preeclampsia. I have never used either of those tests or the ratio to predict, diagnose, or prognosticate my patients with a suspicion of preeclampsia. Ever. That is not part of our workup. I've never used it to diagnose preeclampsia. I've never used it to predict or to counsel them on their prognosis. Now that we have this, I may say to patients, okay, if it was available in my hospital, we did this ratio and you have a high chance of developing preeclampsia with severe features, which is also along with that, you know, we won't go through all the different ways to diagnose preeclampsia with severe features or the progression too. There's a lot. Or you have a very low risk of it. Okay, so what do I do? What does that mean for this patient? It's not going to change. I'm not going to say, so I'm going to send you home because you have very low risk and we're not going to do anything. We're not going to do all the visits for antenatal surveillance or do your labs. Definitely not going to say that. I'm still going to do everything the same. So this is what preeclampsia is like. It is not an easy thing to manage. It's not an easy thing to predict because a lot of different things can happen. For example, if I'm keeping a patient in house for preeclampsia without severe features, say they, because they can't, they don't have the support, they don't have the transportation to be managed as an outpatient, or they've had shoddy prenatal care, they don't come to all their appointments, I'm definitely not going to send that patient home. I'm going to keep her in house. We do the labs weekly. We are doing NSTs or some kind of antenatal fetal surveillance daily on this patient with a plan for delivery at 34 weeks. So many things can happen between now and then. She could start having spiking severe blood pressures that require IV antihypertensives and they don't respond. She could start having D cells on the NST. She could start having symptoms like headache that doesn't go away with Tylenol, pain up into her ribs, vision changes. There are so many things that could bump them into that preeclampsia with severe features diagnosis. So this is something that has to be taken seriously. So before I feel comfortable sending anyone home, there are a lot of things that have to be perfect for me to send them home because things can change so quickly. And this test is not going to make me any more comfortable sending a patient home if the level is less than 40.
Okay, just kind of recircling back to that last question. If you were to redesign this...
I wouldn't necessarily redesign this study. We have a cutoff value, right?
Yeah.
So what would the next study be? You have maybe a similar patient population, and you decide to have two different arms where you manage one conservatively and more lenient, or you keep some in-house versus sending some home and see what happens. Measure the outcomes to see if this is able to change how we manage them. So right now, the standard of care is the same. If we want this to make a difference, we need to see what it could do for what its clinical utility is, meaning how does it change outcomes? And we don't have that. So there's a lot of different ways you could do that. I mean, we could spend a whole hour discussing that. But
that's the study that you would need to see.
Yeah. I would need to see what its clinical utility is. How is it going to change my management of the patient for mm-hmm. the better? Do I not need to do as many labs? Can I not send them in for so much testing? Because as someone that's outpatient, that's a lot of visits.
Right. And I understand the desire for that. But it's like, boy, take a look at every test you've ever ordered. Mm-hmm. Chest x-ray, CBC, platelets, mm-hmm. liver enzymes. Have any of those studies ever gone through that type of gauntlet?
But we are talking about a condition that causes a lot of cases of severe maternal morbidity and mortality, particularly in our Black patients. And one of the things that I'm worried about, especially in that patient population with what, you know, you see the media, you see these reports, you see what happens with our Black pregnant patients, especially with preeclampsia. I'm especially worried about those patients. I don't want anyone, their standard of care being changed based on this because they are such an increased risk for severe maternal morbidity and mortality from this disease. And we're also talking about two patients in one. So we need to put those tests through the ringer. We really do, if we can. But right now we have some pretty good guidelines on how to manage these patients in order to maximize both maternal and fetal benefit. That's why we don't pull the trigger on all preeclampsia patients with severe features at 28 weeks or 24 weeks, which can be diagnosed. Or, you know, we try to get more time out of them with intensive surveillance. Preeclampsia without severe features, we also have a cutoff too. So it is not that easy. And it has to be something that has to really be a game changer because right now we have a lot of patients with bad outcomes from preeclampsia.
Okay, tubular secretions. We always start with swap. Swap, what have you been watching recently?
So I've been watching this TV series on Apple TV called Slow Horses.
Oh my God, I've been loving it.
Yeah, Slow Horses is fabulous. There are three seasons. I didn't know about it until three seasons came out. So I've been binge watching them through. It's based in UK, so it's fun, right, with those British accents. And it's about spies, and it's very odd. It's extremely odd, but the acting is phenomenal. Gary Oldman is mind-blowingly good. It's a great series. Yeah, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, the hook is it's about the reject loser spies, right? These are the people who have been rejected from James Bond.
Yeah, exactly. They've been thrown out of MI5, but they've not been fired. They have been put into this, you know, small office
purgatory.
Somewhere. Yeah,
and, it's pretty good.
And they're actually very good. Yeah, it's just fantastic.
AC, tell us about what you've been watching.
So I have not been watching anything lately, but
you've been trying to get some sleep.
I've been trying to get some sleep. We've been reading. And some of the best advice that I got from one of my neighbors was don't read children's books yet to kids who can't demand them. Just read what you want to read and read it out loud to them. And so that you don't go insane before it's time. And so we have been reading, I've been reading Hidden Figures to my daughter, Madeline.
Oh, nice. And has it all been March Madness for you?
It's been March Madness, but I think my secretion is that spring is my favorite time of year because it means baseball season is back.
Oh, I know.
And
yes.
You know, I grew up in New York, so I'm a big Yankees fan. And this is a very anxiety provoking season because the range of outcomes is huge based on the team and the fact that Gerrit Cole's injured. And there's a lot of question marks. It's anywhere from competing for a championship to competing to stay out of the last place in the AL East. But more importantly, I've been coaching my son's little league team the last couple seasons. And I think there's nothing more gratifying than coaching a kid's team and watching these kids develop. And it's just so much fun. And, you know, we're all super busy, and just having that 3 hours, 4 hours a week to forget about stuff and watch these kids play baseball is awesome.
That is awesome. That's awesome. Anuja, what do you got?
Well, I have two boys, so we've been rewatching Young Sheldon with my 8-year-old. And we've been enjoying that immensely. You know, AC's comment reminded me when I was a fellow, I had my first one who was 4 months old, and I actually used to read nephrology books to him. He didn't understand what that's
all. Oh, my God.
That
oh
was
my
an
God.
Advice I got too. So they don't understand what you're reading. It still grows their brain, and you're kind of getting the advantage. You don't have to read children's books to them at that age. So
I did actually read this paper aloud to my daughter.
That's amazing. So I am listening to the Dune audiobook on Audible, and it is excellent. So Frank Herbert's Dune, it's voiced by a bunch of different actors. It's not a teleplay. They are actually just reading the book, but they have different actors doing the different characters. And I am enjoying that immensely so far. So far, so good, at least. Okay, thank you, everybody. This is a good podcast. Not a great one, but a good one.